Turn to 1 John chapter 4. And this is a verse I read recently in another context. But it says in verse 1, "Beloved, do not believe every spirit, but test the spirits to see whether they are from God." Why? Because, notice, many false prophets have gone out into the world. That last part of that verse is especially relevant to what I want to talk about tonight. Hey, come on in, guys. We're just getting started. We're going to be discussing tonight Islam, which is a major world religion. I kind of thought this would be good to maybe follow up our discussion of the cults over the last few months with this talk on Islam, especially since Islam is so much in the news. In fact, it has been for quite some time, especially since 9/11, right? But even more so in recent days with what's going on between Israel and Palestine and Iran, even as we speak, Islam is all over the news. Even the stuff in Minnesota is related to Islam, at least indirectly, some of it is. So come on in, we're just getting started. So as I just said, Islam is a major world religion that has its roots in Arabia, Saudi Arabia, literally. But it now exists, you know this, Islam exists on every continent in the world. And it's growing rapidly everywhere. I don't have the latest statistics, but I think it's still safe to say that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. It's not the largest religion in the world. Christianity still has that claim, but Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. And so in our time tonight, I'm going to share with you a little bit about the history of Islam, as well as its major doctrines and practices. I'm going to give you what I think every Christian needs to know at the very basic level about Islam. If time permits, I may offer some suggestions about reaching out to and evangelizing Muslims. May not be that much opportunity here in Ewing to do that, but I know over on the campus where I work, there's a few Muslims around, and you never know who you might meet. But let's start off by talking about the history of Islam. I'm going to just give you a brief sketch, just a brief overview. I'm not going to be able to go into a whole lot of detail, but I'm going to give you at least the basic backstory. And of course, Islam, the history of Islam starts with a man named Muhammad, right? You've all heard this guy, Muhammad. Now, before I go any further, I will say this. There's been some recent research lately by more than one scholar, but the only one name comes to my mind, a scholar named Robert Spencer, who has written a book or two arguing that Muhammad, the man, at least as we know him, never existed. He's a fiction of history. Now, I'm not an expert on that topic, and I can't give you enough or know enough to let you know whether the research behind this is that solid. I've listened to a few YouTube videos and such reviewing his work and even heard him talk a couple times. And some of the arguments that Muhammad never existed are pretty good arguments. It's pretty good evidence. But I'm not going to worry about that. Let's just leave that aside. Maybe when more research is done and more discussion takes place, that argument might be more solid. Right now, we're just going to assume that Muhammad was a real person. And I'm going to give you the history of this. And I'm going to tell you this history pretty much the way you would hear it from a Muslim, right? I'm going to just give it to you the basic story as a Muslim might tell it. So Islam, the religion, was founded in A.D. 610. A.D. 610. That's 600 years after Christ, right? In the city of Mecca, which is a city in where? Where's Mecca? Uh-oh, I thought y'all know that.
You said Saudi Arabia.
It's in Saudi Arabia. Modern-day Saudi Arabia. It wasn't called that then. It was just called Arabia. But a city in Saudi Arabia by this man named Muhammad. He, though, was born, of course, sometime before that. He was born in 570. And he was a caravan merchant by trade, right? He traveled with caravans all over that part of the world, trading goods and so on, right? A caravan merchant. He was married to a wealthy widow named Khadija. I'm probably not pronouncing that right, but that's the best I can do. Khadija. But in AD 610, when he was 40 years old, he claims to have received a prophetic call from God. The angel Gabriel, where have you heard of him? Sandra, where have you heard of Gabriel? He's everywhere. He's in the Gospel of Luke and the book of Daniel, right? According to Muhammad, according to the story, Gabriel, the angel that we've heard of, supposedly appeared to him to deliver to him the first message of what would later become the Quran, the Muslim holy book, right? It's very interesting, though, and I find this the most fascinating part of this entire story. According to even the way Muslims tell the story, when Muhammad started receiving these revelations from quote-unquote Gabriel, Muhammad himself thought he was being visited, perhaps even possessed, by a jinn. J-I-N-N, a jinn. What's a jinn?
Demon.
That's an Arabic word that means demon, right? It's the word from which we get the word genie. Right? Like I dream of genie. A jinn or a genie is a demon, right? In all the movies, they're fun. They're all barrels of laughs, the genies, right? But no, it's a demon. So he thought he was being visited by a demon. Good guess. My belief is, assuming Muhammad was a real person, I don't believe that if he was a real person, I don't believe this story is made up. I believe that this story is true and that he did get revelations from a supernatural source. But it wasn't Gabriel. I think it was a jinn,
well,
a demon.
One person can be named
Gabriel. Well, of course, a demon could lie, right? I believe he was visited by a demon. But here's the rub. Sorry, ladies. I'm going to pick on the ladies here tonight. Muhammad thought he was being visited by a jinn, but his wife, Khadija, talked him out of it. She said, no, you need to believe this is real. This is from God. So it's all the wife's fault. Why we have Islam today. It's all her fault, right? Well, in the months and years thereafter, Muhammad received more prophetic messages, and he began to preach to his relatives and his friends and to other people on the streets of Mecca, calling the people to forsake their native polytheism, right? Polytheism, belief in many gods. The Arabs were polytheists, pagans, right? He called them to forsake polytheism and their idolatry and to worship Allah, the one true God, and warned the people of a coming day of judgment. This was the central motif of his message. But then most of the people in Mecca, how do you think they responded? Not well at all. He was pretty much rejected by almost everybody in Mecca. Right? And they even began to persecute Muhammad and his small band of followers. And in response to this persecution, they fled from Mecca and went to another town some distance away, also in Arabia, another city called Medina. Maybe you've heard of Medina, right? This city still exists to this day, right? Just like Mecca does. So this happened in 622. Muhammad and his small band fled to Medina. This flight, as they call it, the Arabic word is hijra, H-I-J-R-A, which means flight or fleeing, right? This flight marks a significant point in Muslim history. The Islamic calendar actually begins with this event, the hijra, right? The flight to Medina. And it marks the origins of Muslims as a social and religious group. That's how they understand it. Their group began officially with the Hijra in 622. Well, in Medina, unlike Mecca, Muhammad was fairly well received. And one of the reasons for that is because the Arabs were more sympathetic to monotheism, which is the message that Muhammad was apparently preaching. The Arabs in Medina were more sympathetic to monotheism, and one of the reasons that that was the case, probably the major reason that was the case, is because in Medina there was a very large, you know, relatively speaking, large Jewish population there. And they're monotheists, of course, right? And so the Arabs there had already been kind of desensitized to monotheism, right? Before too long, the Medinans were converted to Islam. The Jews, however, did not convert. They did not like this message. Muhammad thought they would respond well to his message, but no. To his surprise, the Jews rejected him and his message, and so Muhammad expelled them from Medina. They had to leave Medina. This marks the beginning, guess what, of Muslim-Jewish hostilities, which is continuing to this very day.
Wow.
Right?
So it was Muhammad's fault.
Pretty much, yeah. No, it was those Jews' fault for not believing Muhammad, right? Yeah. But anyway. Well, within 2 or 3 years after Medina converted to Islam, hostilities broke out between the Muslims at Medina and their still pagan neighbors back in Mecca. This time, however, Muhammad's military strength was sufficient such that he was able to hold his own against the attacks of the Medinans. And by the year 630, him and his army had conquered Mecca. They had conquered it, put it under their sway. And they made Mecca the capital of Islam, the Muslim religious capital, Mecca, which it still is to this day, the religious center, if you will, right? Soon after that, many other Arab tribes all around Arabia began to gradually convert to Islam, a lot of it through the sword, right? Just conquering various cities and towns around, right? Muhammad, though, died. The conquering of Mecca took place in 630, as I said, but Muhammad died in 632, just 2 years later, he died. But as you well know, his religion did not die with him, right? The Muslim clans were highly organized under his successors, the so-called caliphs. I'll say more about them and what that word caliph means in a moment. But through military conquest, Arab power and Muslim religion began to spread outside of Arabia within as little time. Think about this. This is amazing. I mean, this is one of the most amazing historical stories in history. Within as little time as 12 years after Muhammad's death, the Muslims had conquered Egypt, Syria, and Iraq. That's huge, right? They already had Arabia, right? Within 100 years, they held all of North Africa, much of the Christian Byzantine Empire in what today we call Asia Minor and elsewhere, southern Europe, right? Mediterranean Europe. They had conquered some of the parts of the Byzantine Empire, and they had crossed the Mediterranean Sea at Gibraltar and conquered Spain. Did you know that? The Muslims occupied Spain for hundreds of years. Hundreds. And if it were not, I want you to think about this. If you get your maps out, what divides Spain from France and the rest of Europe? A mountain range called the Pyrenees, right? If it were not for the Muslims' defeat at the hands of Charles Martel, the French noble, at the Battle of Tours, in 732, the Muslims would have crossed the Pyrenees into the heart of Europe, and you and I would all be speaking Arabic today. And I'm not exaggerating that. There's no doubt about it. So we all owe Charles Martel, and I think his either his son or grandson Charlemagne, a huge debt of gratitude. Right? Huge. Cannot overstate that. Well, there's a lot more history from 732 on to today, right? A whole lot of history. But that's all I'm going to tell you about their history. That's the backstory about how this religion got started and how it began to spread throughout the world.
Well, they finally crossed.
Say what?
They finally crossed the pyramid.
Well, yeah. Well, that's what's so fascinating to me, Rhonda, is that what the Muslims couldn't do in 732 at the Battle of Tours by force, the Europeans have allowed them to do voluntarily by immigration, right? Isn't that something? That's a story all by itself, right? But yeah, I've said this before in other lessons, but I guess I should say it here. Unless something really, really drastic happens, and drastic may be an understatement, within 30 years, every major Western European country will be majority Muslim and will probably be a Muslim theocracy all over Europe. And it may be inevitable. There may be no way of turning that back. So if you want to visit Europe while it's still Europe, you better make your plans soon, right? That's what I want to say. Anyway, all right. Let's talk now about the branches of Islam. You may or may not know this, but Islam is not just totally unified. There are different denominations of Muslims, just like there are Christians and Jews and other religions. There are a whole bunch of different Muslim groups. Some of them are very small. And I don't know that much about the smaller ones, to be honest. But I'm going to tell you about the two major branches, the two biggest branches of Islam that make up 99% of Muslims, right? The first group is called the Sunnis, S-U-N-N-I-S for plural, right? The Sunnis. This is the vast majority of Muslims. About 90% of Muslims are Sunni Muslims, or traditional, what I might call traditional Muslims. When Muhammad died in 632, it was agreed by most Muslims that existed at the time. It was agreed that a successor to Muhammad be appointed or even elected by the Islamic community. The only stipulation was that the successor had to come from Muhammad's tribe, the Quraysh tribe of the Arabs. Other than that, it could be anybody, and it was going to be decided by the community as a whole, right? And the appointed successor got the title Caliph. I mentioned that word before, right? Caliph. Caliph just means deputy or representative. The Caliph is the person who is going to be Muhammad's deputy. And his job, his one and only job, is to guard the Islamic teachings and traditions from dilution and attack, right? So basically to guard Islam, right, against aggression and heresy from their perspective, right? The great Ottoman Empire. You've heard of the Ottoman Empire? If you're ever in high school, that may have come up. The great Ottoman Empire, which lasted until the end of World War II in 1917, 1918, was governed by Sunnis. In 1924, though, just a few years later, the caliphate was abolished. The office of the caliph was abolished. Anybody know why? Can you guess? What happened at the end of World War II World War I to the Middle East? There are a lot of countries in the Middle East now, if you look at a map, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, so on, right? Before 1917, none of those countries existed. The Arabs were just a loose confederation of tribes, right? But after World War I, the Brits and the French and the Americans and the Germans got together and partitioned that part of the world up with these arbitrary borders that no Arab would have recognized, right? The borders between Jordan and Syria and Lebanon and all that, that's created by Europeans, right? Did y'all know that? Okay. But each of those countries now, Jordan, are ruled by their own kings and or presidents, right? Egypt has a president, Jordan has a king, and so on, right? And once you have these national leaders in place, you don't need the caliph anymore that's overseeing all of Islam. Although there has been a recent time with the rise of what's called ISIS. Remember that a few years ago, ISIS? That was an attempt to bring back the office of the caliph and the caliphate so that you'd have a transnational Muslim nation, so to speak, right? Hasn't succeeded yet, but there are certainly some people trying to do that, right? But anyway, that was the end of the caliphate in 1917. So that's the Sunnis. 90% of Muslims are Sunnis. The other group that makes up a little less than 10% are called the Shia, or sometimes called Shiites. You've heard of Shiites, right? That the technical word is really Shia. But anyway, how did they come about? Well, yeah.
Who are the Sufis?
That's some kind of offshoot cultic group from a Muslim perspective, if I'm not mistaken. And I honestly don't know that much about them. I probably need to look into that more. Well, let's go back. I said that the Sunnis, after Muhammad died, wanted to replace him with a caliph that was elected from the community. Not everybody in the Islamic world was happy with this idea of a community-appointed successor to Muhammad. Nor were they happy with the idea that his successor would be just a guardian of Islam. They didn't like that. Rather, some of them believed that there must be a divinely appointed successor to Muhammad. Muhammad was appointed by God. His successor should be appointed by God. Right, you see? And they also believed that this successor, divinely appointed, should be just as authoritative as Muhammad was. Be able to give new revelations from God. Right? If that has to be the case. Right? Just as authoritative, just as infallible as Muhammad. Such a successor, they gave the title to the successor they thought should follow Muhammad. They called him an Imam. I-M-A-M with a capital I. Not to be confused, let's be careful. If you go to a typical mosque, even a Sunni mosque, right? We're talking about the Shiites. But if you go to a Sunni mosque, the leader of the mosque, roughly their equivalent of a pastor, is called an Imam with a small I, right? So don't confuse it with that. The capital I Imam is the person that's supposed to succeed Muhammad, lead the entire Muslim world, right? The Imam. This divinely appointed Imam, they believed, had to be a descendant of Ali, the adopted son of Muhammad. Muhammad never had any children of his own. He had an adopted son named Ali, and the Shiites believed that the Imam, should be a descendant of Ali. Okay. All right, so that's the two major branches. Doctrines. It's pretty easy to describe Islamic doctrine, Muslim doctrine, because this religion is pretty simple as far as its doctrinal commitments, right? And that's probably one of the attractions why it grows, right? It's because many people find this religion very simple, at least in some respects, right? Basically, there are five major doctrines every faithful Muslim has to believe. Number one. Allah is the only true God. Allah is the only true God. Muslims adhere to a strict Unitarian monotheism, and they adamantly reject polytheism or anything that even smacks of polytheism. Indeed, Muslims consider the greatest of all sins to be the sin of shirk. That's spelled S-H-I-R-K, shirk. What is that? Anybody know what that means? Literally, it means assigning partners to God. Assigning partners to God. Or putting anybody up as equal to God, right? The Quran says in Surah is like a chapter. In the Quran, Surah 4, verse 116, it says, quote, God forgiveth not joining other gods with him. It's the unforgivable sin to be a polytheist. What do you think they think about Christians?
Polytheists.
Why would they think we're polytheists? Because we believe in the Trinity. Right? Now, it's not polytheism. We don't believe that. But that's what they think of it. Right? Okay. So, in Muslim belief, God or Allah is the absolute sovereign monarch who requires human beings to submit to him absolutely. In fact, the very name Islam means submission. That's what the word means in Arabic. Islam means submission. And a Muslim is one who submits. That's what the word means. One who submits. So Allah is the only true God. That's their first belief. Number two, there are angels of whom Gabriel is chief. there are angels, of whom Gabriel is chief. Angels play a very prominent role in Islamic theology, primarily because of the role of Gabriel in delivering the Quran to Muhammad, right? Remember that from a few minutes ago? But get this. According to Muslims, every human being is attended, accompanied by, if you will, two angels. Now, you and I, most of us here, believe in guardian angels. But these angels aren't guardian angels. They're called recording angels. And what do you think they record, Nicholas? What do these angels record? Can you guess?
Everything?
Well, sort of. Zach, what do you think they record? Your actions. Good or bad actions, right? I'm not making this up. One angel sits on your right shoulder and records all your good deeds in a book. The other angel sits on your left shoulder, records all your evil deeds in a book. That is exactly right.
Do women have two?
My understanding is yes, but there's some other qualifications there. We'll come back to that, perhaps. Muslims also believe in Satan, the leader of a group of evil angel-like beings called, I already told you what they're called, what?
Jinn.
Jinn, right? Demons. So they believe in angels, of whom Gabriel is the chief. Number three. There are four inspired books, four divinely inspired books. One is the Torah. What's the Torah, you Old Testament students? Jordan, you're taking Old Testament.
First five books
of the Old Testament. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, right? That's the Torah. They believe the Torah is divinely inspired. The second one is a book they call the Zabur, which is most of the Psalms, the book of Psalms. They believe in the Injil. What's the Injil? I-N-J-I-L. That's the word for gospel. They believe in the four gospels. That's inspired. And, of course, last but not least, the Quran, right? Which Muhammad got from Gabriel, according to the story, right? Now, I say they believe in four inspired books, and that may surprise you. But for all practical purposes, though, only the Quran functions as Islamic scriptures. Because why? Anybody know why? Anyone guess?
Everything else is correct.
All those other three books, the Torah, the Zabur, and the Injil, have been corrupted. Those nasty Christians and Jews took those pure revelations from God, which originally matched the Quran almost word for word, and changed it, right? And we messed it all up, right? According to them. So those books, we don't have those books in their pure form anymore, right? In fact, Muslims believe the other books, as I just said, contain basically the same message as the Quran. But since they're distorted by Christians and Jews, God had to send another book, the Quran, to replace all those, right? Okay. Number four. There are prophets of whom Muhammad is the greatest. There are prophets of whom Muhammad is the greatest. True prophets of God have been sent by him at various times in history to various peoples. They believe in lots of prophets. Such prophets include Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Ishmael from, Abraham's son, Ishmael, Jacob, Moses, David, and Jesus. All prophets of God. But Muhammad is the seal of the prophets. That means the last and most important prophet, right? The final and most important prophet. Say a little bit more about Jesus here. They believe in Jesus. They say they will. They believe he was a prophet, but that's all he was, right? They believe he's simply one of the prophets. He certainly was not God incarnate, by no means, according to them. Such an idea is repugnant to Muslims. They vehemently deny the Trinity, as I've already suggested, holding that is shirk, right? Which for them is the unpardonable sin, right? Now you gotta be careful here because they do allow Christians to convert to Islam, right? So it's unpardonable, right? Well, they would just say that you and I are ignorant, right? Now, but one thing that really is unpardonable is if you're a Muslim who converts to Christianity or just leaves Islam. That is absolutely unforgivable. Okay. All right. So they'll give lip service to Jesus as a prophet. But the Quran says in Surah 575, it says, quote, Christ the Son of Mary was no more than an apostle. Many were the apostles that passed away before him. So he's an apostle, but no more than Noah or Abraham or Muhammad. Right? They do believe, interestingly enough, in Jesus' virgin birth. They will say he was born of a virgin. They believe in lots of the other miracles that Jesus is said to have done in the Bible, right? They also believe that God raised him up to heaven, but not from the dead. He was raised up to heaven without dying, without ever dying, like Elijah, right? They deny that Jesus died on the cross. Why? Because no true prophet of God could ever possibly die such a humiliating death. So Jesus did not die on the cross. He was miraculously transported to heaven. Rather, when they were nailing somebody to the cross in Jerusalem, right? Someone else was miraculously substituted for Jesus at the last minute. Nobody knew it except, well, Muhammad. Right? Isn't that a story? Now, not every Muslim believes this. Be careful of this next thing I'm about to say. They almost all believe that somebody replaced Jesus on the cross, right? But some Muslims believe that that was Judas, because he deserved it, right? Right? Judas was the one who was put in Jesus' place.
Too much
of that one angel, yeah. Okay. Anyway. All right. Last doctrine. There will be a last day. There will be a last day in which the dead will be resurrected and judged. Allah will decide who will go to heaven and who will go to hell. Each person's works will be weighed in a scale, right? The angels will open the books, right? And those whose works are mostly good go to heaven, and those whose works are mostly bad are condemned to hell. There's no assurance of salvation, though, in Islam. There's no assurance of salvation in Islam. Muslims cannot ever be sure. I mean, think about it. Nobody can be, right? They can never be sure that they fully met the requirements of how many works, good works they have as opposed to bad works. Those things are hard to count, aren't they, Janet? Hard to count, right? So you can never be sure about that. And in any case, even if all your good works do outweigh your bad works, according to Islam, God's under no obligation to let you into heaven anyway. So many Muslims, maybe I think most Muslims, believe that God's decision as to who gets in is mostly arbitrary. Right? So those are the five doctrines. You believe that, you're a Muslim. Right? That's all, about all there is to it. Right? Let's talk now, lastly, about the five pillars. Like columns holding up a building, right? Five pillars of Islam. This refers to five religious practices, not doctrinal beliefs, but practices that every faithful Muslim has to do. The five pillars of Islam. The first pillar is called the Shahada. Shahada, or I used to pronounce it Shahada until I heard somebody on TV pronounce it Shahada, right? What's that? Well, it's the confession of faith. Confession of faith. Every faithful Muslim must sincerely recite a brief confession of faith. In fact, saying this confession with sincerity is all there is to becoming a Muslim. You want to convert to Islam? All you have to do is believe and say out loud the following words: there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. If you say that sincerely, you're a Muslim. That's it. You guys have to believe the Baptist Faith and Message. That's several pages long. All they got to do is believe that one sentence. Right? It's a lot easier. to become a Muslim, right? There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet. But you have to be sincere, of course, right? Number two, salat, which is their word for prayers. Prayers. The Muslim is required to pray 5 times per day. At dawn, noon, mid-afternoon, sunset, and night. Prayer must be performed, it can be performed anywhere. You can do the prayer anywhere. But men are encouraged to do so at a mosque where they can gather together. And they all must pray facing toward Mecca. Right? You have to pray facing toward Mecca, which I'm pretty sure is somewhere that way. Right? Okay. And if you go to a mosque, they usually have something on the floor. Looks like a compass pointing toward Mecca, so you'll know which way to face when you pray. Right? It's kind of convenient. Right? Okay. The third practice is called zakat, or almsgiving. This is the pillar of social action. Muslims have the duty of sharing their wealth with those who are less fortunate. The common practice, according to their law, the Sharia law, is 2% of one's annual income. 2%. Now, before you get all proud and stuffy and say, well, we do 10. Well, if we did 10, very few Christians actually do it, right? Muslims are pretty faithful at it. 2% of their annual income. Fourth pillar is called Saum, S-A-W-M, which means fasting. Fasting. Every year during the month of Ramadan, and they go by a lunar calendar, so it's at different times. It constantly goes through our calendar at different times of year, right? And I forget now when it is this year. Can somebody, would you look that up when Ramadan is this year? But I lost my place, sorry. During the month of Ramadan, which is the 9th month in their calendar, Muslims must abstain from food, drink, and sex during the daylight hours. Not even water, right? Although they have made some exceptions if you're living in the middle of a desert, like Saudi Arabia, right? But that's another matter.
February 18th.
Starts February the 18th. Okay. It lasts for 30 days, right? So during the daylight hours, no food, no water, no marital intimacy, right? This provides time, of course, for reflection and greater spiritual devotion. They almost always end, if they can, they end the fast every night after sundown by gathering together as communities, usually at the mosque, and they share a meal at the mosque as a group, right, usually. I've had the opportunity on at least, I've lost count, at least 3 occasions, maybe 4, of visiting mosques on Ramadan, during Ramadan, being invited and being able to go in there and enjoy the meal. And I'm telling you, those Muslims can cook, right? That's some good stuff, right? Spicy, very spicy. Really enjoyed that. And we were able to, me and Craig Brent, well, I told you all I used to work for a ministry called the Apologetics Resource Center, right? Back in Birmingham. We would go to the mosques during Ramadan and we would do apologetics right there in their own building and share the gospel. And they would listen. Of course, we had to listen to them too, Nick, but that was just price for admission. Right. All right, the last pillar is the Hajj, H-A-J-J, Hajj, which means pilgrimage, pilgrimage. If possible, every Muslim is required to make a pilgrimage to Mecca at least once in their lifetime and to worship at the great mosque in Mecca. You may have seen pictures of this or videos of this. In Mecca, there's this big giant arena, like a huge stadium. And in the middle of that stadium is this giant box. It's a building, right? It's about as high as this ceiling, right? And just as big, maybe as big as this room, the whole room, right? A big cubicle box in the middle of this stadium. And the Muslims make a pilgrimage for miles and miles from somewhere in Mecca to this great mosque, they call it, right? And they'll circle around it, thousands of them circling around it at one time. Maybe you've seen this on TV, right? And praying and so on, singing as they go around the great mosque, right? And it's interesting, inside that building, is a sacred object. The building doesn't matter, but because they've torn it down and rebuilt it several times. Inside the building is something called the Kaaba. Anybody ever heard of the Kaaba? Nobody, you've never heard of that, Robin? It's a meteor. It's a meteor. I think it's about this big. Don't quote me on that. But it's a meteor that fell out of the sky and landed there in that spot. And they built this building around it. And for some reason that I don't know the history behind this, for some reason they believe that God sent that meteor there for some reason. And so they venerate that meteor in the Hajj, in the pilgrimage. Right? Very interesting. Any questions about any of that?
How long are they supposed to pray each of those 5 times a day?
That's a very good question. I don't know for sure. Now, I've been in the mosques observing this from the sidelines, and it's been several years ago. It's been 20 years ago. My vague guess is about half an hour, but it might not have been that long. It might have been shorter than that. And there may be different differences between the different prayers. Some prayers may go longer. There's 5 of them during the day, right? So I wish I knew more about that, but I don't. But it's not a huge time. Right? But they have some rote Quranic verses that they quote that they have to go through, kind of like a catechism during this time, right? It's all in Arabic, though, by the way, which is fascinating because most Muslims don't speak Arabic, but they have to do the prayers in Arabic. So they're just mouthing words they don't understand, right? It's very, very interesting. Did y'all know that most Muslims are not Arabs? Did y'all know that before I said it? We associate Islam with Arabia, but the biggest Muslim country in the world is what? Indonesia. It's the biggest Muslim country in the world. They're not Arabs, right? They're Asians, right? Okay. Oh, by the way, I forgot to mention. I said earlier that there's the two branches of Islam. There's the Sunnis and the Shiite, right? Or the Shia. Some of what's going on in the Middle East today can be explained by this, because most of the Muslim countries that we're familiar with around Israel, Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, right? They're all Sunnis. But there's one, and as far as I know, only one country in the world that is strictly Shia Muslim. Anybody know what it is? It's been all over the news the last couple weeks.
Iran.
Iran is Shia. If there's any Sunnis there, they don't live long. The Sunnis and the Shia hate each other. They've been at war for 1,000 years. And what's interesting is that when Muslims migrate to other countries that are not Muslim countries, like the U.S. or Great Britain, Muslims will congregate together regardless of their denomination, Sunni or Shia, until the group gets large enough to start a second mosque. And then you've got Sunni and Shia, and they never come back together because they hate each other. The Sunnis consider the Shia to be heretics. They're not true Muslims. And, of course, the Shia return the favor. Okay? All right. And that's why the Arabs that are making peace with Israel right now, the Sunni Muslims that are making peace with Israel, Jordan, Egypt, Syria, right, making a pact, they hate Iran. They're more than glad to jump on board in anything that's going to put down Iran. Iran is the enemy to Jordan and Syria and Lebanon and Egypt. In fact, and Iran's been trying to conquer them, right? Anyway, it's very interesting. All right, many Muslims also add a 6th pillar, right? I said there's 5 pillars, but many Muslims, maybe the majority, add a 6th pillar known as, you've heard this word, jihad, which is sometimes translated holy war, right? That's actually not a literal translation. The word jihad literally means struggle. Struggle, that's what the word means. To be more precise, however, Muslims distinguish two types of jihad. There's the greater jihad and the lesser jihad. The greater jihad and the lesser jihad. The greater jihad, the one that Muslims emphasize the most when this topic comes up with non-Muslims, has to do, the greater jihad, has to do with the individual Muslim's inward struggle against his own sin, right? In Christian terminology, the greater jihad is the struggle for sanctification or personal holiness, right? And if you ask a Muslim about jihad and don't qualify what you're asking about, that's what they're going to talk about, right? But though many don't like to acknowledge it, there is another jihad, the lesser jihad, which is an actual war, physical, violent, bloody war waged in defense of Islam. Now, of course, Muslims are usually quick to point out that such a jihad is defensive only. That's what they'll say. It's only defensive. That is, the lesser jihad is only fought in self-defense when Muslims or Muslim nations are attacked. Now, of course, here's where it gets kind of murky, though. What counts as an attack on Islam can be interpreted very broadly. Very broadly. Most of the fundamentalist terrorists that get all the press on TV, right? They see, for example, American export to Muslim countries of our immorality, right? Our alcohol, our pornography, things like that as an attack on Islam, and that justifies them bombing the World Trade Center, right? For example, right? And if you are, and if you're a Muslim living in a non-Muslim country, you're a threat to their way of life by what you believe and what you do, right? And so they feel, some of them, not all of them, feel they can wage jihad on you. And not only that, though many Muslims won't say this out loud to non-Muslims, they do believe that they're supposed to spread, just like we believe we're supposed to spread Christianity, they're supposed to spread Islam too. Although they believe they have permission to spread it with a sword. They literally believe that. Right? Many of them do. Now, not all Muslims believe that, and not all Muslims, even those who believe it, won't say it. But many of them do. Do you have any questions so far? Anything else? How many Muslims? I was going to do some other things, but we're out of time. Let me close with this question: how many Muslims do you think are of this quote-unquote militant variety? The ones that want to blow things up and send suicide bombers into synagogues and churches and restaurants. Let me back up and ask another question. How many Muslims are there in the world?
2 billion.
Close to 2 billion now. When I wrote these notes and was lecturing on this right after 9/11, it was like 1.3 billion, right? Give or take, right? It's grown a lot. 2 billion. And people will say, some people will say, and a lot of Muslims will say, that Islam is a religion of peace. You ever heard that? It's a religion of peace. And truth be known, most Muslims do not want to blow things up or kill people. Most Muslims don't. The majority of Muslims don't want to do you any harm, right? Only about 10%, according to most statistics, want to do those kinds of things, or of the fundamentalist variety.
Only that's the ones that are outspoken.
I'm going to come back to that. But let's just go with that number for a minute. That it's only 10%. There's 2 billion, right, Oliver? How many is that? 10% of 2 billion?
200 million.
It doesn't give me any comfort to know that there are 200 million Muslims that want to kill me. Sorry. Doesn't matter how many don't want to kill me. That's almost as many people as in this country. Right? We have about a little over 300 million in this country, right?
350.
Is it 350 now? Okay, wow, more than I thought. But that doesn't give me any comfort. And truth be known, that's actually a kind of a misnomer. After 9/11, there was a research poll, worldwide research done by the Pew Organization. Very reputable a polling and research organization. And they did a poll all over the world of Muslims asking, one of the questions they asked was, do you believe that the attack on the World Trade Center on 9/11 was justified, morally justified? And you have those, those answers on polls, right? Strongly agree, neutral, disagree, strongly disagree, right? And 10%, give or take, you know, roughly 10%, said strongly agree it was justified. And so it's all over the papers, all over the world, in the Western world, 10% of Muslims believe in jihad. Most Muslims are peaceful. And that's all you heard in the media, right? We don't need to worry. It's only 10%. Let's don't worry about, you know, let's don't drum up Islamophobia and all that, right? But what they didn't tell you, and what did not make any press, is if you read the fine print on that Pew Research, yeah, only 10% said strongly agree. But another 50 or 60% said agree. Right? So it's a lot more than 200 million. A lot more. All right, that's all I got to say. Any questions? All right. That's what every Christian needs to know about Islam. There's a lot more to be known. I don't consider myself an expert on this. There are others who know a lot more about it than I do, especially the history. But those are the basics. All right, let's close in prayer. Zach, pray for us.
Father, we thank you, God. Thankful for your